Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Coming up on this week's show, the longest-running console war is over.
One of the oldest instant messengers is finally closing.
And we chat to Orbital legend Paul Hartnell.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our sponsor and, of course, great friends, Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen the book that everyone is talking about recently? N64, A Visual Compendium, which tells a story of the console that changed the gaming world and, of course, covers all the big titles, more than 150 that define the N64. They're all in there. Super Mario 64, GoldenEye 007, Ocarina of Time, Banjo-Kazooie, and lots more. Have a look at that and check out the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 431, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for the podcast that every single Friday, just a bit of a time out from the world, isn't it? You know, we take time off working hard and all the stresses of life to enjoy our favourite hobby, the wonderful world.
A bit of an escape,
world.
Dan.
That is it, the wonderful world of retro video games. So that's what we do every single Friday, bringing you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last week, and of course bringing you a very special guest on the show as well. Now, speaking about things that we do outside of retro gaming, you know, all us three are big music fans, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love to DJ. I love to dance, well, badly,
yep.
You know, at parties and raves. And I know Joe is a heavy metal legend as well.
I don't know about legend, but yeah, I'm into the heavier side of things, as well as some synth wave and a little bit of trance. Yeah.
And I've been a DJ for over 20 years as well. You know, used to, back in my day, I was always in nightclubs every night of the week. And I think that's definitely one thing that kind of goes hand in hand with video games. You know, the fact that music's such a big part of them, isn't it? And there was definitely that period from, I'd say, the mid-1990s onwards when kind of the two cultures joined, didn't they? You know, we got into the PlayStation era in particular, and it felt like, you know, dance music and club culture really had a big influence on the soundtracks of video games.
Yeah, and also computers as well. So, you know, you had the PlayStation, you had the kind of game soundtracks as well, but then you had the development of a lot of this music was done on, you know, like Amigas, Ataris, and later went on to the Macs. People were doing them on the PCs as well. So I always love having these kind of huge musical acts on. And it's really cool, actually, because we discussed retro technology as well on this podcast. And previously, we've had some pretty cool acts on as well. We've had DJ Yoda, Aphrodite, Pete Cannon, and Utah Saints as well. But this week, we have Orbital. And it's absolutely mad, because Orbital are a huge pioneering rave group, and we've got Paul Hartnell from them. It's two brothers, Paul and Phil. If you don't know Orbital, you should know Orbital, because I remember watching them on television when it was Glastonbury, and it was one of the kind of first ones where they had extended footage of Glastonbury, and it was like a really long one, and Orbital's set was one of the biggest audiences I've like ever seen. And that whole kind of rave group was born from the idea of the raves on the M25, which would be on the circular orbital motorway. That's kind of why
that's where the name came from.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah.
Because all the time, I remember when Chime came out, and that was like a game changer. I mean, for those maybe outside the UK, you might not be familiar with it, but definitely look this stuff up. I mean, they were pioneers, like you said, of the rave scene, formed in 1989. But the reason we're talking to Paul from Orbital is because their song's actually featured on quite a few video games back in the day.
Well, Paul's a secret gamer, basically. He tells us about like his gaming history and how, you know, he was meant to be making albums and editing, and he would also have games installed on his machines, and that would distract him and, you know, put back a few weeks when he should have been doing other stuff. But also he tells us about, you know, his work with the Atari, and he was using C-Lab. He wasn't using Cubase, which is a popular piece of software that people were using at the time, but his love for Atari as well. But then going into the Mac stuff, then later on, of course, you know, Wipeout, what a huge title Wipeout was.
Petrol was on there. They tracked Petrol on the PlayStation version of Wipeout, I remember.
Yes. And there was huge other bands as well. You know, you had the Chemical Brothers involved with that, Left Field, Prodigy as well, with some of the later Wipeout games. And also his music went onto soundtracks of some of the most iconic, like 90s kind of video game movies as well.
See, that's the thing, because Joe, like you said, you're more of a rock kind of guy, aren't you, Joe? But you knew the name Orbital as soon as you were like, I recognise that song, Halcyon.
Yeah, it's on Mortal Kombat at the end.
Yes.
Hackers as well.
Yeah, and you guys just told me it's in Hackers, which I didn't know. But yeah, it's in Mortal Kombat, the movie, the decent one, the first one, which is cool.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting interview, and actually, it's not any of you guys with me.
No, didn't want us on.
Yeah. We got Pete, and Pete basically hooked us up with Paul, which was great because they met. He tells us the story of it in a video game shop when Paul was looking for a copy of Silent Hill for the PS1.
Nice.
So it's really interesting, and you know, we've had Pete on the podcast before. He's one of our patrons, and he's our kind of resident Orbital expert. So it was great to have him on because they hang around at gigs at the end of it. And I think he just sorted him out with a PlayStation 2 as well. So that's pretty cool. All fully loaded with tons of games on there. And he's been enjoying that.
So that's awesome. So yeah, you and Pete are going to be interviewing the Orbital legend, Paul Hartnell, talking about, of course, his love for all things gaming, the video games that the Orbital tracks appeared on, and much more as well. Producing music as well. I always find that interesting, you know, when we hear about how the tracks that, you know, kind of shaped our childhoods were actually produced on.
You know, we talk about raves a little bit and how, you know, phone numbers and like pirate radio and the old technology was used to do these big gatherings before social media. It's a really interesting interview.
So Paul Hartnell from Orbital is going to be our special guest on this week's show, and he'll be coming up in around 40 minutes from now. But of course, you know the way the podcast works. First half of the show, that is when we have a little bit of a retro round table and bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And this has been the big headline that I've seen everywhere this week, that Atari have finally purchased their old rival, well, actually their oldest rival. Atari now own the Intellivision brand.
I feel like I'm repeating myself whenever we talk about kind of modern Atari at the moment. They know what they're doing. Like,
to a degree.
But like, it just feels like, you know, when we first started the podcast, it was, you know, like I say, Broken Record or Atari are trying to make a hotel, they're trying to make casinos. It was just really stupid, bizarre things. Whereas now they really are concentrating on what they know the people love. And it might not be as like grand and like as money making as a casino, but the casino stuff was just, it was just nonsense. Whereas this is like, yeah, you know, let's look back at our heritage, let's look back at the last 50 years of Atari and we'll do a game about that, or we'll buy, you know, this company, and or we'll, you know, release the Atari VCS 2600 Plus. Like, it all makes sense. And is it Wade Rosen? Like, I just feel like he knows what he's doing. But I did love their statement when they said that they'd bought the Intellivision and how the Amico will remain a separate brand, essentially.
Which really did make me laugh. They made that very clear, didn't they? Yeah, they did make that very clear that the Amico is not part of their plans. So probably a good thing to get that out there, I think.
Yeah, not a lot of people know what the Amico was. It was the previous owners of Intellivision, wasn't it?
And it's Tony Tallarico.
Yeah, and it's kind of a new take on it as well. So I guess they were just kind of like, we want the old brand and the new stuff you guys can kind of keep. I don't know if they'd be able to have Intellivision Amico on there or just Amico. Yeah, to be honest, I don't know enough about it. I know it is a big hoo-ha and a big kind of a mess at the moment.
It is probably the biggest piece of vaporware, you know, since the Vega Plus, probably. So yeah, I don't think there's any danger.
That's the thing about Atari, you know, they've actually released things, and even the VCS, you know, it did come out and it wasn't vapor, and that's a good thing. But also having all these brands under one roof means if that collapses, then what happens? You know, that's one of my worries. You know, I kind of like having stuff separately and rivals and competition spurs each other on. Like, you know, once they've released a certain amount of stuff, are they just gonna, you know, go, right, we're done with that, move on to the next, purchase another brand, and kind of turn into this huge group?
Well, to me, it sounds like the reason that they've, because basically what they've bought is the Intellivision brand and the rights to more than 200 games from the Intellivision portfolio. They haven't released a list of the games, because I've seen a lot of people kind of getting excited about the fact that it might be, you know, all the classics, like Astro Smash was like a big game on the Intellivision. You had Tron Deadly Discs, Night Stalker, Burger Time was on there as well. The only thing is, it was, as we mentioned before briefly, it was Tommy Tallarico who most recently owned the Intellivision brand. But actually, it turns out there are certain IPs that he actually sold off to other companies, including some of the most famous ones like Astro Smash, which Intellivision sold off a couple of years ago. So I imagine that is not going to be part of their plans unless somehow Atari can maybe buy the rights back, because that is going to be a bit of an oversight, you know, in the catalogue. I think if they're going to be releasing, for example, a mini Intellivision console or something like that, and they want to have the big games on there.
Yeah, I was wondering where they will go with this, and I, you know what, mini console didn't cross my mind, and now you say that, I do feel like that will be the obvious choice. I was thinking they might have done an Intellivision 50, you know, like,
yeah,
with a compilation of games and stuff, you know, on modern consoles.
Cartridge releases, like the Atari.
But, Yeah, like you say, like that. But yeah, now I'm thinking maybe they will do an Intellivision Mini. You know,
or both.
Yeah, true. Yeah, Atari.
The amount of Atari consoles that they've released, or, you know, different versions of it, has been insane recently. Yeah. So, you know, they've had all these arcade units as well and stuff, and home units as well. It's been interesting to see. If you do go on the Atari site, check out the amount of products. It's mad.
Yeah, the fact that Atari have also been releasing, and you know, as we've covered on this podcast, you know, games for the original systems as well, and, you know, even those arcade boards that they were putting out there as well, it does definitely feel like they really respect the legacy of these IPs and the systems recently, which is nice to see. So, I mean, in my mind, yeah, I think you're right, Joe. I've got a feeling there will be probably a very nice, you know, maybe Intellivision 50 celebration, something like that.
You know, it feels a bit like a game collector's in charge of Atari. You know, someone that kind of collects it and has a passion for it.
Well, they've got a close relationship with Digital Eclipse. So something like that would be amazing to see, like a, you know, documentary style collection of the biggest Intellivision brands. And, you know, as we know, they're not adverse to making new systems as well with the Atari 2600 Plus. So I think, you know, having Intellivision under their banner, I think, you know, the big headlines that everybody in the retro gaming world has been that these systems, when they were released back in the late 70s, they were arch rivals. And now, you know, they've kind of gone out there with the headline of the longest running console war in history is finally over. Because these were like the OG systems that were competing against each other, and now they're part of the same company. So yeah, that is kind of quite nice to see.
And I think, like, you know, stuff like the Atari 400, when they released that one, you know, that was something that I didn't think would be that big, because it appeals to a certain audience, like in America. And I've seen that loads of people have gone for it in Europe, and you know, it's sold really well. And I think Intellivision's an area that they need to explore in Europe as well. And I think that might appeal, as you said, with a mini, putting that out and then suddenly people going, oh, I never had one of those. Let's have a look.
So, I mean, you know, all of us guys in television and the Atari 2600, like before our gaming years. But I think it's always interesting to kind of look back on where it all started. I mean, even though, you know, Atari 2600 games don't hold my attention for all that long, if I'm honest, but, you know, I do like booting them up and having a quick, you know, 10-minute play on it just to kind of see where it all started, really. So I think from that perspective, I think there'll be quite a lot of interest. And, you know, like the Intellivision, not a system that I've ever really played on. So I think if they do release a, you know, mini system or a modern version of it for an affordable price, it could be something I'm interested in, just to kind of see those first generation consoles in all of their glory. So yeah, looks like you know, Atari haven't obviously bought this for no reason. So there is going to be something happening with Intellivision and the games that they now own at some point in the near future, I imagine. So that's a story we'll keep an eye on. If you want to read more, I'll link up that story in this week's show notes. Now, moving forward in time to something a bit more recent, but still 20-plus years old. You know, it is the retro era after all. Let's talk about the Sega Dreamcast. Now, again, now this is a system that, you know, all three of us have got a lot of affection for.
I love the Dreamcast, but this has got me a little bit worried. So what we're talking about here is a new PSU for the Dreamcast, which actually looks pretty cool, but costs as much as a Dreamcast does. Is there, maybe Ravi knows, are the PSUs and the Dreamcasts dying?
I think there's lots of issues with the with the PSUs in the Dreamcast. Stuff like GDMU,
right.
You know, where you're basically putting in an SD card replacement. That requires some heavy modding with Dreamcast PSUs. I know there was the Pico PSU, there was a Dream PSU, which is cheap, but I know there's been lots of problems with, I think, the Dream one. Lots of problems with overheating. There's kind of been problems with getting the correct voltages as well. I think you can you can end up damaging the Dreamcast with some of the PSUs that are out there at the moment. I know there's like a scale of them, but I haven't gone through and, you know, checked every single one. But this one looks like it's a real high-end one that's going to try and solve a lot of the problems at the moment, and it requires no soldering or anything like that.
Yeah, well, that's where it kind of caught my attention as well. So this is called the Thunder Dream, and according to the manufacturers who made it, it's going to be, it's plug and play universal, so, you know, you can just plug it into any Dreamcast and it's professionally made. But it does,
well, it's internal, so you just drop it inside the Dreamcast.
You clip it in, don't you? But it does come at a price of $95. Now, I would say the average cost of a Dreamcast in the UK, at least, is probably between £70 and £100, depending on the, you know, kind of quality of it and stuff like that. So it's kind of a case of whether you think it's worth it, or, you know, if the PSU on your old Dreamcast has died. As far as I know, mine's still working. I've never had any issues with it. But the idea of this is, you know, it does have things you've just mentioned there, you know, they overheat and the voltages are incorrect and stuff like this. On the Thunder Dream, apparently it will detect the voltage automatically and it will change, you know, it just knows what to do. It will change to whatever voltage it needs to be, you know, what's going through it, and it'll adapt, as well as very low heat generation. So it shouldn't overheat, you know, that's your solution there.
Because the Dreamcast is packed very tight, isn't it?
Yeah. And then also very low noise. So it's going to be 30 MVPP. I'm not too sure.
Which I think is, like, I don't know, if you've got the CD-ROM drive in there, it's pretty noisy, other fans.
Yeah.
But I think they're all dying off, yeah.
I've got a feeling by very low noise, they mean electrical noise.
Yeah.
So right. Talking, I mean, like, yeah, you know, when you get like an old power supply and the caps are kind of failing. I had it on my CD32 and you kind of get like interference on the screen.
I actually thought the actual, because the Dreamcast is quite loud, I thought it was going to like reduce that, but I see what you're saying now. So I guess it's just whether you think it's worth it or not. If you've got a Dreamcast that needs this, you know, $95, I don't know, feels a little bit steep for me, but I also am aware of what it is doing for you as well.
I think it's, in terms of value, if it's well made, which by the looks of the specifications and the work that's gone into this, it doesn't seem unreasonable to me, because you know, I've bought power supplies for other systems that are highly rated, like, you know, a Commodore 64 replacement one. I've got a few for my Amiga as well. So I think the power supply isn't the one thing that is most likely to damage your system if it fails.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I had a Commodore 64 power supply once that fell off the table, like one of the old really awful Commodore ones, and it fried the RAM chips because there was no like inbuilt protection or anything like that. And that was quite common. And the thing is, when you've got systems like, you know, the Amiga CD32, my power supply was failing on that, and I had that weird interference on my screen. I replaced that with a third-party one off eBay. But the thing about the CD32 is their external power supplies, it's a lot easier just to kind of find one and, you know, get the right plug and plug it in. With stuff like systems where it's an internal power supply, I do think it's more of a concern. For example, you know, we've got like the Sega Saturn would be another console that probably would need looking at as well. Because you get into that age now where, you know, I've got consoles that have internal power supplies that are only a few years older than the Dreamcast, where the capacitors are starting to fail in the power supplies. For example, my 3DO failed a couple of years ago. So I had to like recap that, the power supply inside there. So it kind of feels like, you know, now that they are like 25 years old, it probably is something that is going to become a, you know, bigger issue as power supplies and capacitors start to fail inside them.
Yeah, yeah. I also think, like, you know, Dreamcast, there's a lot of those limited edition ones, like, that become really rare and
some
quite expensive ones. Maybe it would be good to, you know, if you're going to fork out on one of those, you'd fork out on one of these at this price. But, you know, it's the first one. Maybe it will get reduced later on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If you buy a decent power supply for your PC, I mean, you're probably talking a similar kind of price, aren't you? You know, for a high-end power supply. So if you want to keep your Dreamcast going for many more years to come, and like you said, I think the good thing about this is it is literally plug and play. So, you know, there's no soldering required. You don't have to cut up the case or anything like that, as you often do with third-party ones. So, yeah, they've actually said it's built for perfection rather than budget. So if you want a decent power supply for your Dreamcast and a bit of peace of mind as well, you know, to keep these systems going, then I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, I thought this story was really interesting. This is a unreleased iPod Tetris clone that has recently been discovered on a beta firmware from an iPod third generation. Now, I must admit, this was something I didn't even know this was a thing. But watching this video, I think this plays quite well.
Yeah, it looks quite nice. I do remember Brick, which was the original one on the iPod.
Breakout clone, which makes sense because Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs made that game, didn't they, at Atari back in the day?
Yeah, and I remember later on they introduced a few ones. There was like Solitaire on there and Parachute.
Music Quiz.
And, yeah, stuff like that. And I really enjoyed the interface of the wheel. And, you know, I didn't have an OG iPod, but some of my friends did. I had a Creative audio player, which was this huge, huge kind of just a hard drive with buttons on it. But I absolutely think this would have worked really well, you know, if they release it. I wonder why they didn't.
Well, this is a video that we'll link up that you can check out on YouTube, and it's by a YouTuber called who calls himself Apple Demo, which makes sense. Looks like he covers a lot of kind of unreleased Apple products and prototypes. And in this video, he's got a third generation iPod from 2003. Now, you remember that was a really weird one. That was the one that had the those illuminated four buttons that were separate to the scroll wheel. So if you want to play and skip tracks and everything, it wasn't around the edge of the scroll wheel like it was on the original and the later models. They were separate on this. But he's got this this basically demo version of the iPod third gen that dates from around 6 weeks before the final product shipped. So it's pretty close to release. But the good thing about this is he's actually got some beta firmware on there. And it turns out there is a in-house Tetris clone that is called Stacker that you play on the iPod's monochrome screen using the scroll wheel to control the Tetris pieces. And watching this video, I agree, Ravi, I think this plays really well.
Yeah, and I think maybe he'll, I don't know about Apple and stuff, but maybe he'll make it available so people can flash their ones. Because I know there's a huge modding scene where people are adding in, you know, flash memory. They're adding in new batteries. And people are modifying these iPods. And it's a whole kind of collector group around the iPods. It is quite good. And I can imagine you've probably got Doom running on an iPod somewhere as well.
Well, I think if this had been released it would have a lot of productivity time would have been killed back in the early to mid 2000s if we all had a, you know, portable version of Tetris in our pockets at that stage. Not much work would have got done at colleges and universities. But I think you asked why it wasn't released. I've just got a feeling that it was probably purely down to licensing.
Yeah.
Because it would have been, very expensive to kind of get an official license from the company that owned Tetris, whoever they were at that time. I know various different people owned parts of it and different.
But also, I think there's a thing to be said about having MP3 players as well, still, because, streaming music, if you don't pay for it, you get adverts. It's reliant on connections and stuff. It's nice to have something where you can just plug it in and you're not connected to the internet.
Well, I am. You mentioned about there's quite a big iPod collector scene, of which I am part of. I've got my original first generation iPod, and I've got one of these iPod third gens in my collection as well. So I would be interested to get this working on there. You mentioned about whether we could release this firmware so people could play it on their own iPods. It's interesting because he mentions in the video that usually what happens is when you buy an Apple prototype, they wipe the hard disks in them so people can't basically see these beta revisions of the firmware. But when he got hold of this iPod that was a development unit, the disk wasn't working in it. And it turned out, I think it was like the ribbon cable that connected it to the motherboard that basically was the failure. And when he replaced that, then the hard disk that contained that beta firmware was accessible.
It slipped through the net.
Yeah, pretty much. They must have looked at it and thought, oh, the hard disk dead, not worried about it. So it looks like, I'm not sure how many other versions of this are out there, but it would be cool if he has the nerve to release it. I mean, personally, I can't see Apple being all that bothered about something that didn't come out 21 years ago. But I also understand if he doesn't want to release it, I would get his reasoning behind it too. But it would be cool to play, because I think, it looks like the interface actually would control pretty well using the iPod scroll wheel. And I'm going on holiday soon. I generally do bring it's normally my iPod Classic that I take on holiday with me. I've got 160 gigabyte iPod Classic from like 2009.
I used to have a Nano. I love that thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few Nanos in my collection. But as you said, then it's, having an offline device and also having, I've got loads of like DJ mixes and albums that I've ripped on there as well that are not available on, services like Spotify. A lot of them are on YouTube and stuff, but then, being reliant on hotel Wi-Fi and stuff like that is a bit of a pain when you're relaxing around the pool on holiday. So I do like to bring an iPod with me, for the hotel room and stuff as well. So it would be nice if I could play a bit of Tetris on there this year. So if you want to check out that video, very cool. I'll shove that in this week's show notes as well. Now, last week on the podcast, we were talking about that amazing Mario Maker for Super Mario 64 that allows you to make your own Mario levels on the N64. And I did say on the podcast last week, wouldn't it be amazing if someone made some new levels or you could make them for Mario Kart?
You did.
And here we are 7 days later and someone's only made it happen.
Your cries have been heard.
They have. So this one admittedly is for the Super Mario Kart version for the SNES. Mm. But this is, looking at this, they're calling this an expansion pack. But to me, this almost looks like it could be a sequel to it. This could have been like Mario Kart 2 for the SNES.
Yeah. Yeah, 100% could have been Mario Kart 2. This is Horizons expansion, which looks absolutely fantastic. So this has been created by Grid Attack. And what it is it says it's an expansion to Mario Kart, but I'm looking at it as more as it's a new version of Mario Kart, Super Nintendo Mario Kart, because it comes with 8 custom worlds, which includes 20 different racetracks. And if I remember rightly, there was only about 20 tracks on the original game anyway.
It's like a replacement of them all, pretty much.
Yeah, so it's a replacement of them all. And then I really like the colour palette that they've done here because of what their aim was to do was not just make new levels. They've done all new backgrounds, all new styles, there's like Egyptian themes and like Mine Train themes and stuff on here. And obviously, Super Mario Kart used the Mode 7. So it's that kind of flat looking world. So there's only so much you can do to make that look different. But I think by changing the color palette on this to make it look more unique is what they're saying has really, really worked. I think this looks really beautiful. And then I did think, I was like, graphically, this looks a little bit different as well. But there's actually some upscaling on the pixel art in here as well. So they've redone some of the assets in the game, some of the weapons, some of the characters, and just made it all look a lot more polished and clean. But what's really wonderful about this is you can play this on your Super Nintendo, on your flash cart as well. So it's not just online, it's not just, you know, on the internet or whatever, on your computer. It is, you know, download the ROM, put it on your flash cart, and it'll work on the Super Nintendo with no modding or anything like that. And that's all with all the revamped sprites and everything as well. I think it looks beautiful, and it's so frustrating that there's so much cool stuff being done like this by the fans, and Nintendo are just like, oh yeah, Mario Kart 8 still. And you're just like, yeah. Stick something like this on the Switch. People will buy it. It's fantastic. It looks awesome.
But also,
yeah. If this is on the Switch like store, I would definitely pay for this.
But also, I think this isn't just like a ROM release where they've just chucked it on. They've also put all this extra media on, which is mad. They've got like a soundtrack that you can download, game manual. They've got custom boxes as well. They've done like NTSC and PAL versions. And they've got a cart label as well. So, you know, it's like the complete package this is.
Mm. Yeah, and to me, I mean, they're calling this a ROM hack. So you do need the original ROM for Super Mario Kart. But to me, yeah, it does kind of feel like all they've done is really taken the engine, really, and kind of replaced everything else in the game by the looks of it. So you've got, you know, 8 custom themes there as well, new locations. Like you said, the 20 racetracks. You've got 4 battle tracks in there as well. All the colour palettes have been remapped and changed as well. You've also got a brand new soundtrack to the game. They've replaced all the tracks in there. The sprites have been changed. The drivers, the vehicles, the obstacles have all been given a new look. The menu screens, wow. There's new content in there that you can unlock as well. They've even tweaked some of the mechanics in there as well. So it does seem like, this is pretty much, like I said, it's a Super Mario Kart sequel, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
definitely.
If you ever wanted more content for your Super Nintendo and a new Mario Kart game, this is called Super Mario Kart Horizons. Of course, it is completely free. No one would have the nerve to charge for this, I don't think, with the threat of Nintendo looming. But there have already been nearly 2,000 downloads at the time we're recording this. So if you want to check it out, that is available on our romhacks.org. And I'll put that link in the show notes as well. Now, this was sad news when I read it, because thinking about the early days of being online, and those of us of a certain age, I'm sure this sound will bring back some memories. You know what that is?
Yes, ICQ, of course.
I think I sat in the Christmas quiz one year, and didn't you say it was a lemming, Joe?
Yeah, I've got no idea what ICQ is. I thought it was a lemming or a worm, yeah.
Although, to be fair, it does sound quite like a lemming, I've got to say. But that was the messaging sound for one of the internet's earliest direct messaging services, ICQ, that obviously stood for, it was the letters ICQ, but it stood for I seek you, as in, you know, I want to find you.
I track you down, yes.
Yeah. Which I must admit, this story is that the ICQ service is finally closing down after almost 28 years. Now, it did start back in 1996. I think its peak was probably around 98, 99 maybe. I think I signed up to ICQ probably around 97.
Yeah,
and I used it probably until around 2000 when I changed over to MSN, and Yahoo Messenger kind of replaced it for me.
I used IRC before, and that was like chat rooms, you know, internet relay chat. And then ICQ was my first instant messaging experience, and it was really good. It was in the days when I wouldn't leave a computer on 24 hours. You know, I'd turn it on and then you'd get loads of messages that were like left by people and stuff.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a few, who's online? There'd be like 3 people. And then, you know, you could chat to them, but also it had this kind of a weird thing, which is probably pretty dodgy nowadays, which was you could look up like local ICQ numbers and it would just match you with someone totally random. If you didn't have that many people, and you could just be like, hey, how are you doing? Like, where are you?
Who are you? ASL?
Yeah, exactly. And it didn't, I don't know if it even had emojis, but I remember
using smileys on there, I think.
Smileys, just yeah. And it was like, obviously MSN Messenger was when it got huge, but that was years after ICQ. ICQ, I would say a lot of hackers were using ICQ back in the days, and it was kind of used for a lot of trading of software and stuff like that as well, and being able to contact people directly. And it was when the internet was a lot of a smaller place, you know.
Yeah, and I enjoyed ICQ. I'm trying to remember my number because he had a number rather than a username. I've got a feeling mine was 905216.
Yeah, I can't remember mine.
Can't remember my wife's birthday, but I remember my ICQ number from 25 years ago. But it was, I mean, it was, you know, a revolution when that came out, being able to direct message people across the internet. And then obviously paved the way for, you know, stuff like AOL Messenger was massive in America. Not so much over here. I mean, generally it was more MSN and Yahoo that me and my friends used as we got into the 21st century. But I must admit, I wasn't even aware that ICQ was still going.
Yeah, I'm amazed by that. Yeah, I'm just remembering some of the things now. Remember, it had like an answering message, like an answer phone kind of. People would leave messages and voicemails on it.
Vaguely.
I remember that, like later versions, you'd get like just random voicemails like, hi, how are you doing? it was quite good. But yeah, I can't believe it's still going. I'm amazed. And I reckon the news of its death will probably add more interest.
I've seen a lot of people saying that, like, just send one final message to my number, here it is. I've seen that, like, a lot of comments and tweets and that this week. But it turns out, I mean, obviously IRQ was started by a company called Mirabilis in 1996, an Israeli company, and then AOL bought them in 1998. So they took over it. And then obviously there was the Time Warner acquisition. So that kind of, obviously that was a famously bad merger back in the early 2000s as well. Then it turns out, I mean, that the timeline after that goes a little bit murky. Apparently AOL sold it to a company called Digital Sky Technologies, and then this company called VK. So basically got sold to a Russian company who've owned it since 2010. But apparently it turns out that ICQ was actually still quite popular in parts of Eastern Europe and Russia. So
it was a solid system. It worked well. It did its job, you know. Yeah, I could see that. And I think there's that Escargot thing, which is basically MSN Messenger and Live Messenger that's been redone.
Yeah.
Changing the servers and stuff. And that's still a service that's used, and you can use that locally on a LAN, or you can kind of use it online as well. I think there's going to be a fan kind of ICQ that will come out of this.
You don't think they'll let it die?
No, of course not. Of course not. And I'm going to start using it and trying to find some friends, because it'll be very lonely.
To be fair, you're right, because they did bring back MSN Messenger, didn't they, with third-party servers a couple of years ago, of which I don't know about the security on that. I don't know whether... Except I've not really looked into how it works, you know, kind of sending your messages and stuff through a third-party service where you're not really sure who's looking at it always makes me a bit nervous.
And I think... One thing about ICQ was it wasn't just linked to PCs and Windows. It was on a lot of different systems. It was on Linux, you know. That's why you may have had like more of a geeky kind of base back
then. There was an Amiga version of it as well, I remember.
Yeah. And it to me, it felt a lot more like IRC or something that could be used like universally. You know, you'd be able to make a client and then connect to the protocol, and I think that's what stood it apart, where MSN was very Microsoft, you know, and that was of course the dominant platform then, but ICQ seemed to be everywhere, you know. Yeah,
we all hated Microsoft in the late 90s.
Yes.
Well, it turns out apparently that there has been ICQ apps on the Google Play Store and the iOS App Store, which they've now removed now that they're discontinuing the service. But apparently it also connected to like WhatsApp and Telegram and stuff in recent years as well.
Yeah, I remember using a thing called Trillion, which was like, I could get every messenger service on there. Yeah. And I had like all of them. I was like the boss.
I think there's one called Pigeon that was probably similar. Where you could
log into a bit later.
You could log into loads of different services. But ICQ was definitely the first instant messenger that I used, you know, when I first got online. What about you, Joe? Were you like MSN straight away then? Is that what you
Yeah, MSN. I think I went into like an AOL chat room like once when I was like 11. But yeah, I was MSN as a teenager. Never used this or heard of it until you mentioned it on the Christmas quiz a few years back when I thought it was a lemming.
You never used AIM or Jabber.
No, never used them. No.
Well, it's the thing, if someone does bring back ICQ, that makes it like a, you know, a recreation of it or a resurrection, then me and Ravi are moving over to that full time, so we'll have to do all our podcast, you know, notes and that on, on ICQ. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. And I think, yeah, I've got a feeling the old fans of ICQ might not let this die completely. So it would be nice if they can get like the old Windows 95 apps back online again, wouldn't it? And make them work like they did with definitely. The MSN ones. So. Yeah, so RIP ICQ. If you want to read more about that story, I put that. And of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. You just check the notes section of your podcast app or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, we did have an amazing patrons hangout this weekend just gone. That was fun, wasn't it? This is where we get together, if you haven't heard about this before. Basically, a bunch of patrons, we all get together. I think it was about over 42 of us at one stage. This weekend, it was quite a popular one. I was actually at my mum's house on her very dodgy Wi-Fi, which is retro in itself. I think she's still got like an NTL router or something. I was on my iPad as well.
Diamond cable. That was it. Or something.
Well, I was on my iPad and there was actually too many people to fit on my iPad screen. So, which was nice to see. I mean, you know, it was a really good turnout for it. So, and we talked about all kinds of things and trying to think about some of the things we chatted about.
I went down like a kind of rabbit hole of comics, and we talked about comics for ages, and then we started talking about films and different characters from those and how comic characters influence games as well. And then I went ahead and started a comic channel on the Discord as well.
We're talking about music as well, which is nice because obviously we're all different backgrounds and different ages and stuff, so it's nice to kind of talk to each other about like different genres of music we listen to and stuff. But it's really fun. And I was actually saying to a friend at work the other day who was asking me all about the podcast, and it was kind of like I was saying we started it during lockdown in 2020 in COVID, and I kind of always thought it might have like died out, you know, kind of like, and it never has. And it just keeps us all connected. And, you know, people from America come on, and Sweden and stuff like that. Like, it's absolutely awesome.
Yeah, and everyone was sharing their data sets as well. And they were going, we're talking a lot about analog tape and the connection between music and also storing data on them.
Yeah, it's just such a giggle and such a great community as well. Such, you know, friendly bunch of people. And very welcoming to new members as well. So we have got one coming up, of course, end of next month. I think we're going to be moving it because obviously your big Amiga event's at the end of June, isn't it? So I think we're going to be doing it first weekend of July, which might sound quite a way off, but I'm sure it'll be here before we know it. So if you'd like to join us for that, and of course, our patrons community, really the main reason that we run that is just to make sure that we can cover the running costs of the podcast week in, week out. So all the details to join us on there and get access to that exclusive part of our Discord server as well. You can head to our website at theretrohour.com. Okay, then, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. A little reminder as well that we always appreciate a nice podcast review, don't we?
Well, totally, yeah.
Whenever we see them, Ravi's always sending us a little screenshot in our little chat group normally. You know, it warms the cockles, as they say, to see a nice review from people. And not just for that reason, you know, it's not all about, you know, massaging our ego. The main reason that we like a nice review is because it helps us in that all-important podcast algorithm. So if you do listen on a platform that does allow reviews, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, nice reviews and 5-star ratings, help us get in that chart as well. And the most important thing is gets it in front of new people, which is always amazing to see. So if you do get a spare couple of minutes, we appreciate it. Not everyone can support us on Patreon, but it is really easy just to leave a little, you know, take you 1 minute to leave a nice little review, and that will really help out the podcast as well. We would appreciate that. Right then, next, we're going to be chatting to Orbital legend Paul Hartnell. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites.
With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Paul Hartnell. And Paul is from the Supergroup. Yes, Rave Pioneers, Orbital. Absolutely love this group. And this interview is going to be a bit different. We're also joined by our patron, Pete. And I say Pete is our resident Orbital superfan, if I'll call you that. And it's great to have you on. And I think this is going to be a really interesting interview. We're going to talk about kind of technology, the early days of Rave, but then also video games and you know, the influence that some of these tracks had on video games and some of the technology you guys used as well. So Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Ravi. How are you?
Really good. It's good to have you here, and we have a question that we always ask our guests first, which is, what was the first kind of gaming experience that you remember that stuck out to you?
Ooh, first gaming experience that really stuck out to me. Now, I'm not sure which one happened first, but I'm going to have to say Adventure on the Atari, because I got one for Christmas one year, and I had Missile Command. And that's when I first realized that the difference between playing games in an arcade where you've got a limited number of 10p pieces and you're running out of money and you're trying to master this game, to when you get it at home and you play it, you've mastered the game. You can sit there and eat a mince pie on Boxing Day and just play through all the levels. It's just like, you know, you get really good at those kind of arcade games very quickly. And that's when I kind of realized I wanted something more, an adventure. Someone described Adventure and I just thought, that sounds bonkers. And I got it. And that's when I got into, you know, it's so limited, but it's the first open-ended adventure game, go where you like, work it out yourself. And that was the sort of game that really pulled me in.
And were you and your brother both kind of playing it and having goes?
No, well, he probably would have a bit, but he's like 4 years older than me. And my older brother is 7 years older than me, our oldest brother, I should say. And he would have been much more into punk rock and girls at that point. You know, so whereas I was sat around playing video games and nerding out, you know, still watching Doctor Who and things like that. Actually, my older brother, Gary, who went to Cambridge, he introduced me to something, which was the other game I was thinking of, to kind of like a text-based adventure game on a computer in one of the Cambridge computer rooms. But it was all done on paper. There was no monitor. So it would print something out and then you'd type your answer and it would then go and then print out its answer. And it was really kind of intense because of that, because it was all on paper. And then, of course, when it's ultimately, you know, after quite a reel of paper said, you've just died, you can tear it off and take it away with you and just recount your adventure. It was that really opened my eyes as well to just adventure gaming in general. I think it was a big thing back then that you had the program called The Adventure Game, which was essentially watching people do an escape room, which in turn, you know, has been a big thing in video games, especially on phones and things like that. But you had things like Myst, which is a whole big adventure, but it is kind of like a giant escape room.
Good way to put it, actually.
Yeah, all the puzzles to get to the next section, the next room, the next area. And that kind of thing is just so, so compelling.
So you started off with an Atari console. Did you make the leap to another console, or did you go to PCs after that, or computers, or what was next?
Well, when I went from an Atari to nothing. There was a few wilderness years where I got into girls and punk rock. And then I got an Atari STE with my first paycheck from releasing Chime. And that was the beginning of me playing games again, when I remember doing a gig in Manchester and just walking around the Arndale Centre and walking past a shop that was a video game shop. And I went in and just saw the Atari section and thought, oh my God, I can play games on this thing. I hadn't even thought. And
So you got the Atari for music production originally?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The Atari.
So you were using the same machine?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, it's like music production, then you know, evening off. It's straight into Dungeon Master, which blew my mind. I loved Dungeon Master. Was the ultimate for me back then.
Oh, it's an awesome game.
Did you have any go at programming at all, or like typing in stuff from magazines?
Absolutely. Actually, because I did have for a brief spell when me and Phil were working on a building site, he was the bricklayer and I was the labourer. There was another guy who had an old Texas Instruments computer and he sold it to us for next to nothing. And I remember doing all the, you know, go red, go yellow, return, you know, repeat and that kind of thing, and just making it kind of strobe in the bedroom. With flashing colors, but that's as far as I got really with as far as actual programming. When I did try and get onto a course for how to build electronic instruments, and they in the interview they were discussing my mathematical and programming prowess, and that's when I realized, oh, I'm a player, not a maker. And they didn't let me. They asked me if I wanted to make violins instead, and I thought, no, sod that. I you know, I'm not doing that.
Well, I love the kind of name Orbital, of course, and that's based on the, you know, M25 going around, and there was all these free parties and raves back in the days. And this was maybe hard for some of our listeners to understand, but, you know, without social media and stuff, people were organizing these on a mass scale with, you know, party lines on phones, pirate radios and stuff. Do you remember the kind of like illegitimate use of technology on back then, and kind of how it all happened and you know, yeah, grew to such a huge scale?
Indeed. And don't forget the humble printer. You know, it was all about flyers back then. You know, people got flyers and they passed them around and they told their friends, oh, look, Saturday night, ring this number or go to this service station or whatever. And that's what people did. That was you'd find a flyer with a number for a mystery party and off. But that's why everyone was set off around the M25, because you're never more than, you know, like an hour away from the possible destination.
And they'd wait at the service stations, wouldn't they? And then there'd be like one phone box and you'd have to go and ring this line and word would get out, you know?
Yeah, that's it. People were collaborative back then. You know, someone would ring it up and they'd go, well, the party's in Dodo, you know, and they'd turn around and go, right, we're all going to wherever and shout it out, and everyone would peg it off. You know, it was that kind of thing. I mean, I could never really do those parties because I only had a really small part-time job in order to facilitate myself to do music for half the week. And most of these parties, you kind of had to pay to get in. Even, you know, they weren't free necessarily, but the cost of getting in was too expensive for me back then.
I wondered as well, did you get any like mixtapes? Because I know tape packs and mixtapes and live recordings, often some of them, I think they were done on DAT tapes as well at some point, you know, to get higher quality ones later on. But did you get any recordings of like these huge raves and parties?
I've got plenty of mixtapes though from when I went to Australia. I've got mixtapes of two of the DJs that I stayed with when I was there, Ming and Sheen. And I got mixtapes from people early on in like 1990 from people like Shane and Jamie, who were two West Country acid housey techno DJs. They as you met people and made friends, they just give you tapes because that's how you pass the information on. I'd go home and listen to it and I tell all my friends, oh, they're really good. And then someone might, you know, through all of that, through giving out all those tapes, people are going to get jobs and that kind of thing. And they'd always have their phone numbers on it. Yeah, that's how I got a gig in Belfast, because the original copy of Chime had the Ozone Record Shop phone number on it. So David Holmes rung that. Jazzy M gave David Holmes my mum's number when I was living at home. And he just rung up out of the blue. And that's how it was all done. It was all about the phone number and the printed number somewhere.
Yeah, I remember the days of those mixtapes. We used to be swapping around at the school playground and you'd have recordings of recordings of recordings. And
yeah, yeah, for sure. I had some great ones, actually, from Shane and Jamie. They gave me a brilliant one, which was early Eat Static, before they'd ever had any records out. And they were just playing live around the West Country raves. And they gave me this tape of this band. And it was just, it blew my mind, because it was like the first trance, if you like, that I'd ever heard. It was like... acid housey techno stuff with loads of crazy vocal samples, but all this kind of Osric Tentacles type, you know, arpeggiation across the top. And I swear, the term trance, I think, comes from the band Eat Static.
Yeah, it's like early file sharing, but literally, yeah. You know, sharing a tape and then all duplicating it as well. And I guess stuff came over from America as well with the house scene over there and how that kind of got established.
Yeah, well, American 12 inches were like gold dust over here. Imports, always expensive, but always coveted.
I used to spend a lot of time as a kid at Eastern Bloc Records in Manchester, and that was very much a case of you'd listen to, well, back then it was Sunset Radio, 808 State Radio Show, and they'd be playing whatever's there in sort of top 10, if you like, and have all the imports from Italy and America and all that. And I'd save up my paper round and try and get what I could afford to buy, and yeah, all this underground music scene was massive back then.
Yeah, if they'll even admit that they've got it in the shop and not just be saving it for the DJs, because that's what happened to me when I went to Eastern Bloc. Sort of arrived with my soft southern accent and said, oh, have you got Marina Van Rooy? And he said, no, I've sold out. And Sasha was in the shop. He'd come in with me, but they didn't know that we'd come in together. And he turned around and said, oh, stop it. Stop mucking about. Give him one. He went, oh, bloody hell, and just reached under the counter and gave me one. You know, it's like, it's really like who you know.
Yeah, I think they like to keep it local as well, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, why not?
Yeah, they had all the power, those guys.
They certainly did.
So when, obviously, you did Chime, and it's well documented, you know, under the stairs and all that kind of thing, and you were using hardware since connected and very much just doing it on the fly, I guess, or just jamming. When did you start integrating a computer or a door into the flavor there?
Yeah, pretty soon after Chime. I mean, I had a MMT8 sequencer, which was an 8-track sequencer that you could do, you know, do arrangements and songs on, which I used to do sometimes. 9 times out of 10, it was just easier to create all the parts and then just jam it onto your 4-track or a DAT, you know, as time went on. And if it didn't work, you'd just do it again until it did work, until you were happy with one of your jams. A lot of our early singles, like the original version of Halcyon, is just a jam. And also editing was not an easy thing to do. It was very expensive. So, you know, that's why you get 12-minute long Orbital tracks, because it was a 12-minute jam and we couldn't edit it. So it was just, well, there it is. We like the vibe. It seems to work. Let's just go with it. But I first got into using a door was when I got an Atari, and I think we had an advance of something like $2,000, which seemed astronomical to me, to start writing more stuff after signing a deal with London Records. And I spent it on an Emax 2 sampler, an Atari STE, couldn't even afford Cubase, which is what I wanted because I liked the arrangement page on it. But so I went with C-Lab Creator, didn't bother with Notator because I don't read music. So just went with Creator on an Atari, had MIDI on it. And it was like the world opened up to this whole new land, you know, it was next level stuff much easier to arrange things and do, you know, amazing things. I just got it out recently and I settled back into
C-Lab. You got C-Lab out.
Yeah, and an Atari ST. Oh, right. I borrowed an Atari ST because I had to, because I was reconstructing our Green and Brown albums for playing live on the recent tour. And because everything used to be just jammed or arranged and then recorded straight like as a live mix onto DAT, we never multi-tracked anything because we were always doing it at home. So I had to reconstruct it. And I've always had this sort of suspicion that if you plug it in, it's all just going to work. And guess what? It did. I think I have one or two failed files, no actual completely corrupted floppy disks, just one or two files that just would not load. But everything else just worked. And I plugged it into my old trusty old Wave Station and R8 drum machine, and yep, it all just worked, and all the SysX dumps worked, and everything.
Do you find that groups nowadays are trying to go back to their kind of roots? Like, I know the Chemical Brothers are starting using some of their older equipment and setups. Is it kind of good fun revisiting that and something you think people are trying to achieve nowadays? You
know? Yeah, I felt young again, having to wait for the floppy disk to load and watching the Busy Bee on the Atari and that kind of thing. And it's quite zen, because it's like you can't rush it. It's like, oh, I've got to turn it on, it's got to fire up, I've got to load the C-Lab Creator. Now I've got to find that disk that I didn't write on when I was 22 properly, and put it in the machine, find the file, and off you go. And then it crashes, and then you have to do it all again, and you just go, oh, well, you know.
So you were controlling synths with MIDI then through C-Lab, but did you ever consider using Synthesis for something like the SID or computer-generated ones?
No, not back then. I didn't even know that was a thing or even possible. I've got an Electron SID station now, which is a great machine, but I didn't try and do anything like that back then, because this was kind of uncharted, forward-thinking territory. The idea of using a SID chip back then would have been like, you would have thought, well, why would I want those kind of very bad plinky plonky kind of sounds? I'm not insulting those sounds now. I know they're valid now, but back then it would have been no. We're going forwards. This is acid house. This is techno. This is something that hasn't been done before. You know, it was more about finally getting the money to buy something that the big people would have had, like a Wave Station, and then doing things on that nobody else was doing, like bothering to program it.
I've also wondering, like, how much synth pop and the kind of British kind of sound of use of synthesizers influenced you as well, and that kind of history on equipment you were using.
More underground stuff, like bands like Cabaret Voltaire, whole labels like ZTT Records, Factory Records, all of those people were all a massive influence, and people manipulating stuff electronically, like On New Sounds Records, like Tackhead and Keith LeBlanc and things like that. That was like industrial hip hop, and it was such a powerful sound. All of that was very much an influence, and then electro, New York electro, and the American electro scene. And then when house music came along, it was like, oh, okay, this feels like a progression of like Bobby O style high energy disco music and electro. Brilliant. Okay. I can buy into this. This is great. And then I got a bit bored of it all being a bit soul-y and a bit, I didn't really like the soul-y piano house stuff so much. I like the cut up samples and the crazier stuff. And then of course, acid house appeared, which was totally off the scale for had no territory or geography for where it had come from. And then Detroit techno, which obviously had its roots in bands like Kraftwerk and something a little dirtier, but it was putting this stuff into house music that wasn't kind of soul-y. It was much more kind of austere and dark. It was great.
I think it's Joey Beltram did that Ecstasy track, which was one of the first big kind of trance ones as well, like later on. Yeah, I think it's you're right, it's really got that connection, but it's also got kind of a bit of a British feel as well, just having that legacy there.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. I think the British kind of sound of what would eventually become rave music, for want of a better word. Yeah, if you look at people like us and 808 State, even a bit later, Chemical Brothers, but also around our time, Left Field, Prodigy. There's a kind of punk rockness to it that I feel you hear kind of On You Sounds influence and all those sort of dirty electronics you used to get from Cabaret Voltaire and Factory Records.
Yeah, I'd agree. So you had the Atari ST. I did wonder why you hadn't gone to Cubase, and I guessed it might be a budgetary thing back at the time. What, did you start going onto a Mac or something like that after that?
Mac. I've eventually got a Mac for the Insides album. So I did three albums on the Atari, and then switched to a Mac, and I was very suspicious of it, so I kept it in my bedroom and would toy with it until I was fluent, and then I swapped it out for the Atari.
Were you brand new to the Mac then? Had you?
Oh yeah,
used
yeah.
one before.
Totally. Yeah, like, but then of course I discovered Warcraft and lost about an album to to Warcraft. I used to go into work on Saturday morning. You know, I say work with commas in the air, on Saturday, and just play Warcraft all day long. Yeah, and I'd think, oh, I'd go in with good intentions to settle down to do some music. I think, oh, I'd go and just have 5 minutes of Warcraft, and then it's like lunchtime, and you're like, oh, bugger. You know, I've lost half a day to video games, but that was an addictive game.
Yeah. I still have that problem. Yeah, I was wondering as well, when the internet came around, like, you guys had quite a strong community and presence. Steve Price, aka Loops, had helped set up the community. How important was the early internet to you guys and harboring that?
Well, I was always quite skeptical in the sense that it didn't bother me. I didn't really trawl the internet. I quite liked email. I quite liked that. Again, that's that addictive thing, isn't it? I quite like going in the morning and see it and having the little chicken go, you've got mail, you know, and it's like, great. But I never really used to look at the internet that much or think websites were that important. We ended up paying someone big money to do a website. And the first, when they came around, they sent an interviewer around to get the biog kind of stuff. And the first thing they asked us was, well, when did you two meet? And I just thought, this isn't going to go down. This is going to work well. It's like, okay, they've done zero research. And it was always such a painful process to change anything, and expensive as well. And then, like you say, in the background, there was this fan website called Loops, which had far more connection with all the fans and information, and was just constantly updated and working. And then Steve ended up in Kent and thought, I know, their parents have got a pub somewhere in Otford. And so I think he must have done a pub crawl of Otford. But he found my mum and dad's pub because he looked at the jukebox and noticed that every Orbital single was on this jukebox. And it's like, right.
He was stalking you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Pete, you know. Yeah. He calls me baby reindeer. But and then he got chatting to my mum. And then we just kind of stayed in touch. And, you know, Steve's... He may have been stalking us, but he's not a scary guy. You know, he's on the level. He's brilliant. He's a great guy. He now does it for us officially. Well, we ended up sacking off our website and just said, "Do you want to do it?" It's like, you're doing a better job. Will you just do our website? And he was like, "Yeah, great." And so, you know, Steve ended up doing it, and it's never really changed. You know, and he's done a lot. He does a lot of our social media as well, the important posts of telling people we're doing stuff. And he just instinctively knows how to deal with the internet from an Orbital perspective. He's got it all going on, really, which is great.
Yeah, it's good. It's like you say, he's tuned in both to you and online and the internet and how it works and how to get people excited and the idea of building up this network of people, the loopers, as they call them, who, although I was on that forum back in the day, I've kind of only recently discovered it the last few years, the loopers, the guys that are just so into the band that they've got tattoos and all sorts. And it's been great to meet them because they're such a nice bunch of people. So yeah, big shout out to the loopers.
Well, yeah, because I if I get the chance, I'll often because I'm always in communication with Steve. If he's going for a meetup sometimes beforehand or whatever, occasionally I'll nip along, you know, which is always annoying because everyone wants to buy me a pint and I can't have one because I'm about to go on stage. So it's like it's always nice to go and meet those people. You know, you get to know everyone, and I was talking to a pair, Wendy and Tez, at the front of the stage, just about five minutes before I went on in Bearded Theory. You know, you just go down and have a chat. Oh, you're doing all right? Yeah. Anyone else here? And that kind of thing. And it's just like, it's good to be in contact with the people that do, you know, use you as a method of travel. It's like a random, it's like throwing the dice. Where are Orbital going to be? Oh, yeah, that sounds fun. Let's do that. I like it.
Well, they went out to New York, didn't they, as well?
They did indeed, yeah.
That is dedication.
I bumped into him at the front of the queue when I went to go and change into my stage outfit in the hotel over the road.
I guess it's good kind of having an archive of stuff as well. And I was wondering, internet, you know, the audio and the streaming was pretty bad, like, early on. Did you guys ever attempt to do any, like, streaming or internet radio show or any kind of thing like that?
We did something with the BBC. We did a live broadcast from our studio early on. ISDN, I believe, was the method that they used. Is that correct? But they, you know, that required them to have, like, a huge lorry out the front of the building and cables all traipsing through the windows and that kind of thing. You know, it wasn't really a possibility without someone like the BBC back then, or so it seemed anyway.
Yeah. So I know you guys were pretty influential in terms of the early PlayStation scene and how that also kind of had a crossover into rave culture. They were bringing the PlayStations into nightclubs to get the people playing with them. But the game Wipeout was massively popular, which helped to launch the PlayStation, which also, because of its soundtrack with Chemical Brothers and Prodigy and you guys, we had this kind of older generation of people, the teenagers, the clubbers, that were getting into gaming at that point. And consoles became a really good way of winding down after gigs or after a night out and things. Is that how you used them? Sort of.
Yeah, that was getting involved with Sony to do Wipeout. That was my next step into the console. Like, they gave us a PlayStation as part of the process, and so that was the first time I got back into consoles, because, like I say, I'd been very much Warcraft and things like that before then. I absolutely loved it. Again, it was like next level gaming for me. The fact that when they said, you know, we want you to do a piece of music, I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting. Am I going to have to do something limited on a SID chip or something like that? They said, no, you can do anything you like. I said, but how does that work? I thought games had to be done on the machine. I said, no, yeah, it's like a CD-ROM kind of thing, and we'll just put the music on there, which blew my mind, that being able to do that. So they gave me a video of somebody playing the game really well, much better than I could ever play it.
That was hopeless.
About 5 or 6 minutes. No, I was hopeless at it as well. I just used to put that on, and I composed kind of watching that. So like film scoring. So try and match the kind of speed and the feel of it and get that side of it right. So it was like it was composing to film, really.
Did you have an attitude towards the PlayStation that this was going to be a big success? Because in the gaming world, people were like, oh, Sony doing gaming. You know, you had Sega and Nintendo quite dominant. But a lot of people in the audio world, of course, knew about the Walkman, the Discman, the kind of quality of Sony products. Did that kind of influence you?
The first I knew of it was before it was even released. And as soon as I'd seen it, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be huge. You know, it was such a brilliant machine. They gave me a whole bunch of games, like Battle Arena, Toshinden and things like that, and Demolition Derby, which was great fun.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that. So I was straight away like, oh, this is going to be good. And I don't really have an attitude towards certain manufacturers, because they've all surprised us at one time or another. Like when Casio brought out the CZ-101, and everyone's like, Casio doing a synth? Oh my, you know. And then it's like, then they heard it and went, oh wow, this is incredible. And it's like Alesis were always sneered at in the musical world as being cheap and not very good, and they supplied me with so many of my early drum sounds and sequencing machines and things like that. So, you know, you never know what someone's going to come out with.
And I thought the way that they had it as a CD player, but also the fact you could put a CD in there and get visuals on there, was like very connected to the rave scene.
Yeah.
You know, you could just leave the PlayStation on and have visuals going on your favorite CD.
That's brilliant. That's really good.
Like seeing a laser in a rave or something, you know.
Yeah, you know, they were definitely thinking about the young adult world as well as, you know, kids and things like that, which, I guess, like you say, it was actually stepping outside the box, really, for where you would aim a console.
So have there been any other games that you've been kind of invited to contribute to, or have there been any kind of genres of games that you would like to write soundtracks to?
Yeah, I'd love to do Fallout 5. That would be that would be the ultimate. But that kind of, those are the kind of games that I like. I mean, we've had tracks here and there in various games, you know, where they compile things for certain racing games and that kind of thing. But I've never had a chance to do a full game. I'd love to do that. You know, like a story based RPG would be fantastic.
That would be amazing. Orbital RPG. Yeah. Yeah. But I can imagine that could work really well as well if you had a kind of very modern, like, ravey sound and then, you know, a fantasy setting or something. You know, the way they do atmosphere on computer games, that could work. I was wondering what the process of, you know, when you got asked to be on video games, were there any ones that you rejected and you said, no, I don't want to be on that one at all?
Oh, no, not at all. When it comes to things like that, I like a gun for hire kind of challenge. It's like doing adverts and that kind of thing. It stretches your creativity in a different direction, which is good. So it's like working out at the gym on a different piece of equipment. It's good for you. Having to do anything out of your usual comfort zone is really good. So I'll take to any challenge. You know, it's like scoring for television and film. I rarely get to use synthesizers when I do it, because I've done things like Peaky Blinders, which is essentially a period drama. So I had to use cellos, violins, pianos, and electronics. But you know, as the director said, you can use as many synths as you like, as long as I can't hear them. And it's like, okay, yeah, I knew what he meant, as long as it wasn't obviously like bow, wow, and that kind of thing. And it worked really well. I love doing that kind of thing. I love being told, do this with this tiny amount of leeway in a certain way. And it's like, oh, okay, that's how you get your real creative juices flowing, having to do things like that. It's brilliant.
It's often when you're limited into what you can do or limited by your tools that some of the most creative things can happen.
Yeah, yeah. I think when you're young and you haven't got very much equipment, that's when people get really innovative and do really amazing stuff, because they're pushing everything they've got to its limit. And they're really, you know, using the machine to its max potential. And that's brilliant. You know, like now I've got like a studio full of synthesizers. I've got far too many. I just had a bit of a cull recently because it was annoying me that, you know, it's weird. It's a double-edged sword, because if you're into synthesis and sound design and electronics, you kind of want to keep abreast of what's going on. So you do buy lots of new stuff when you think this might be bringing something new to the table. 9 times out of 10, it isn't. And it was just like a one-off dopamine hit, and then ends up like a doorstop because it doesn't sound as good as something you've already got or you know how to use. So I just got rid of like about 17 bits of equipment, and my studio feels so much lighter and better. And I haven't got all this other stuff like haunting me that's saying, use me. You never use me. You know, it doesn't happen now.
I saw that you were selling some of the kit, and I know some of the fans picked it up, and my wife's been using that phrase "get rid of" a lot recently with his moving house, and it scares me. But it must have felt like giving away some of your babies. I mean, these synths, was it like that, or was it just a case of, okay, you've been a good friend, it's now time to retire you?
Absolutely, it's like there's no point getting sentimental over a machine. There really isn't. And anything that I've used extensively on an album, like I've got, you know, an Oberheim expander. It was used in the mid-90s on so much of my stuff. I will never get rid of that, because that one, I may need to reconstruct those albums one day. And two, I know how good it is, and I know it inside out, and I know it'll come around and have its moment again. But things that you bought and went, oh yeah, this is interesting, it doesn't really do what I hoped. Oh, well, that sort of stuff, just get rid of it.
I was wondering, you know, you mentioned floppy disks earlier and how you've got some of your work on there. Have you had any errors with them, and have you seeked out like anybody to clean them or kind of archive them at all?
No, I had a couple of files that didn't open. That's about it. And with that, I just kind of went, oh, well, I will never know what was on that one, which was a badly named file anyway, and may or may not have been what I was looking for. So as long as I found what I needed, I did do one thing. I did reconstruct like in minute detail one of the hardest tracks on the Green album. And when I got to the end, I found the disc with the actual track on it. And I, instead of going, oh, well, I loaded it up and then checked my homework with it and spent another couple of days seeing how well I'd done, you know. And I think I did all right. I think I got 8 with a gold star, you know.
So you were doing a cover of your own tune, effectively.
Exactly, yeah.
It's interesting, I mean, thinking about the cinematic scoring side of what you've done in the past, because you do, or the music you do have, like you've done for Concrete Plans and Peaky Blinders and things, and even like the Insides album, you have those moments of taking the listener on a journey, like a sci-fi experience, and it's like you're telling a story. And it does strike me that you have a lot to offer in the to do soundtracks for games. And Fallout was immediately, I mean, I've heard you speak before about your love of dystopian apocalyptic scenarios. And it just felt like, oh yeah, Paul, Fallout, ooh, soundtrack.
Yeah. I would do any game if you'd want it to be good, if you're going to spend that much time, or they'd need to be paying you enough for you to not care that it's not going to be very good. But it seems to me when games get into development, they're normally pretty good, aren't they? When they're, well, I don't know, maybe there are some bad ones out there, but I just don't play them. I'm very selective with what I play because I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of losing another album to a video game.
I think that the sad thing is we're in a position now where a lot of the games that they're all chasing the blockbuster, they've all got investors, they're all big companies, and they're pressured for them to, it's like the film industry, they're pressured for them to have a success to pay the shareholders back. It means these productions are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they don't want to take the risk. So I think this is why I love retro gaming and playing the older games, that they were done by two or three people or even less, one guy. And again, back to the creativity and the limitations of the old computers.
So it's the same with indie games kind of coming as opposed to the big studio
ones. Indie games out there. Like a thing that I absolutely loved that me and a mate got into over a holiday break one New Year, and that was the Stanley Parable. It's absolutely absurdist, like brilliant game, non-game kind of crazy experience. And I absolutely loved that. Machine Area.
I saw you'd mentioned that. I'd never heard of the Stanley Parable before. And I asked some guys earlier and they said, how have you not heard of that? It was massive. So please, if anyone else hasn't heard about it, what was it about?
You kind of wake up in your office, you're Stanley, and you're just a lowly office worker, and you walk out and there's nobody there and it's just deserted. And you just walk through this office that gets more and more weird and dystopian and kind of what's the word, like lots of surveillance and things like that, and lots of buttons that say don't press me. But this is the clincher: it's got a voiceover, like a narrator telling you what to do all the time, but really witty and funny. And so you have to choose whether you're going to do what the narrator says, or says, and then Stanley walked through the left door. And you've got a left door and a right door. So you walk through the right door and the narrator will go, oh, Stanley picked the wrong door. So therefore, and it's just this constant dialogue taunting you or directing you. And it's a kind of weird open-ended game with multiple endings. I don't think I've ever done them all.
So some games, they do lead you to that idea of, do you do the good thing, the right thing, or do you do the bad thing because you want to see what God, so are you a good path person, or are you a bad path person?
I always want to be a bad path person, but I always end up playing good. I'm always on always max armor in Fallout. I'm a beacon of goodness. And do you know what? I enjoy it more. I just can't be mean to those poor people. I always play good and powerful. It's funny because I would have thought if I was guessing myself, I would have gone for magic and wizarding powers. Nope, I go for great big axes and chainsaws and the biggest laser gun I can possibly find and the biggest suit of armor. I always go down the total kind of muscle route, which is, I guess that's because it's not me.
That's the point, isn't it?
You
get to be what you'd like to be.
Well, I've seen recently there's been like orchestras doing video game soundtrack kind of recreations live. There's been huge live performances. Would you ever consider like doing a live Wipeout kind of play along or something like that?
No, I don't think I would, because I did go through a phase of thinking, oh yeah, I'd love to do, you know, one of my albums with an orchestra. And then it kind of dawned on me over time that it's like, hang on, why would you do that? What is that saying? Because something that often gets said to me when I'm doing scores is, yeah, we want you to use real instruments. It's like, guess what? A synth is a real instrument. And if I was to do Orbital as an orchestral score, it's almost like I'm saying this is how it's supposed to sound. Guess what? It isn't. That's not how it's supposed to sound. It's electronic, unashamedly. And that's what we were doing back in the day. So you will never hear Orbital as an orchestra, which, of course, now I've said that means you will absolutely definitely hear Orbital as an orchestra at some point. But no, my intention will be that it will never be done orchestrally, because I just don't think it's right. I think I've heard Belfast done in Pete Tong's Ibiza Classics Orchestra. I prefer the original. it was fun, but it was like my first reaction was, oh God, they're using an 808 instead of a 909 on their electronic drum kit. Come on, you know. But things like that, it's like, and so for me to be bothered about things like which drum machine you're using means I'm actually still invested in the idea that it's electronic.
Yeah. I was wondering as well, have you noticed, like, I'm definitely seeing stuff in the charts at the moment, more of a kind of focus on the 90s and 80s sound from
massively,
new generation? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got to remember back to, you know, kind of like in the 90s, there was definitely a swing back to disco at times and things like that. It kind of seems to go in 20, 30-year cycles or whenever it's ripe, I guess, you know, whenever the young people start. Is it they're listening to their parents' records? Possibly. And a lot of parents from the 90s have got kids that are old enough to be making music now. So I guess they are listening to their parents' records and it's cycling round. I mean, since...
And I guess it's decades as well. So, like, you know, back in the days, people were getting nostalgic for the 60s and...
Yeah.
And, you know, that... Yeah, and it kind of changes up every time there's a new generation.
Yeah, but I mean, I remember when I first started hearing that and thinking, really? You know, is that what you're doing? Wow. And then sometimes I'll have like Radio 6 on and I'll listen, I'll hear a track and I'll go, okay. Because it could go 50-50 with Radio 6. It's like, is this an old track that I don't know? Or is this some new track? And it's so often, it's just a new track sounding old. And it's good news for people like us, because all of a sudden we sound contemporary again, even if we just play our old tunes. It's incredible.
So it comes round, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I find it highly amusing when I see these young guys with mullets at the moment in terms of fashions coming around.
Who would have thought the mullet would become fashionable in the 90s? It was like something you laughed at. It's like, oh my God.
And the moustache.
Yeah. No, I had a history of art teacher at sixth form college that had a blonde mullet, a big moustache, and used to wear leather trousers. And it's like he was the laughing stock of all of us young people. But God, he
was just ahead of his time.
He's ahead of his time and is probably selling, you know, drip coffee in the lanes in Brighton.
So, you touched on Dungeon Master as being one of your favourites. Around that time, I think I was playing Eye of the Beholder, a very similar game. You seem to be erring towards the IPG, the RPG and the...
Dungeon crawlers.
And open worlds and the storytelling type games. What else were you playing? What caught your attention?
I think, okay, so... I'll wake up at 2 a.m. and go, oh, I forgot that. But Dungeon Master, and I enjoyed, I think it was called Captive, which was like a sci-fi version of Dungeon Master, which was good. I like the strategy games of the original Warcraft and Starcraft. But for those kind of things, it was on the console, it was things like Resident Evil and Silent Hill blew me away. I didn't really like Tomb Raider so much because it was more kind of like an acrobat, you know, stealth game. That wasn't quite, it wasn't quite enough for me. I preferred the storytelling and the creepiness, the atmosphere of the horror games. But I think for me, in the mid 90s, someone recommended that I get the original Fallout, and when I got that, that was it. I lost a summer to that game. It was absolutely brilliant. And also another one, I think it was called Neverhood, which was like animated plasticine game. I think it was on PC.
Rings a bell, that one, Des.
Yeah, and it was like a, again, it was more like Myst in the sense it was like a comedy puzzle game, not that Myst is comedy, but you know, like a, you had to, you'd be stuck on a screen and you'd have to play bells in a certain order that you'd seen on another screen, and then you kind of worked it out. Oh, if I go back and listen to that, that'll open the door, right? But it was really beautifully animated, but it was great. It felt like you were in control of it, even though obviously it was all animation and plasticine. That was amazing game.
Did you ever play any like online titles or you know, connect to any MMOs or anything?
No, really, I don't like playing with other people. I like to be in my own little world.
I'm the same.
Single player.
Everybody I'm killing with my giant axe or laser gun is not really alive, and not going, not swearing at the telly at the other end. I don't like, and also I don't like that thing of then, you know, doing it with mates and going, oh, are you ready? Should we do it now? It's like, no. I'll play when I want to play, which is generally when the family go to bed, and I'll play for an hour or two and, you know, stop at 12 o'clock and move on, you know. So playing with other people is not a thing for me, unless you've got, you know, like my wife Louise doesn't really do video games, but then when I got the PlayStation, she absolutely loved Battle Arena Toshinden, and she would be like a wild woman, like beating the crap out of me and shouting in the room and really enjoying winning that game. So, you know, you never can tell, but doing things like that, a game of two players that's like a quick turnaround, that's often fun.
I was wondering what machines you still have then. Do you use any of the old consoles or any of those things, or have you got like emulation or what?
No,
games on as well.
Yeah, I've got Steam on my work laptop, which is dangerous, and I've got, is it Disco Elysium, which I still haven't played yet. I bought it for long haul flights, and I've been asleep or watching some awful movie. But I've got PS2, PS3, PS4. And an Xbox. I bought an Xbox for StarCraft recently. There was no way I was not going to play the next Bethesda game. And I have to say, while I enjoyed it, I went back to, because I've got the Game Pass on the Xbox, I went back to Fallout 3 and just thought, oh, actually, this is better. Welcome back to the wasteland, sir. Yeah, here you go. There's your crappy, you know, laser gun, and off you go. And it was like, yeah, this is the world I like inhabiting. Starfield was all right, but a little dry, I think. I mean, it looked incredible, but I don't think it kind of worked as well as the Fallout games for me. But that might be just a personal choice of how it's dressed up, you know.
It's great that also on the Games Pass, they've got all the older titles as well. So you can actually just go and download some of the older stuff on there.
No, I know, because I missed out on all the, on Fallout 2 and 3 and New Vegas, because I never had the right machine at the right time. Otherwise, I would have played them. And then now I can just go and do it all, which is just incredible.
How's the PS2 working out then? Are you enjoying that?
I am. I didn't know if we could mention that or not.
A bit of context to our listeners. I think Pete sorted you out with a PS2 recently.
Yeah, he sorted me out with a PS2 chock full of retro games, which earned me untold brownie points with my two sons. boys. One of them's already he spanked through Silent Hill, and he's now, what's he gone on to? Resident Evil 4. He's gone on to. He just jumped 1, 2, and 3 and went, no, I'm going for 4. And he's loving it. They love the retro games. You know, like, so people do now, don't they? They love the quirkiness of it, or the, you know, it was back, you know, I guess it's like early house music. There was no path. It was, people did anything over the top of a house drum beat because there wasn't a set of rules laid down. Yeah. Like club music now kind of has to adhere to certain rules and regulations, otherwise DJs won't play it because it's not necessarily club friendly. Whereas back then, it was that wasn't a word. It was just house music, and you played the tracks you liked. And I think old games are like that. They're bonkers.
It's the same with, that's a really good way of putting it, because it's the same with genres as well. You know, people would just make a game, and suddenly it would become a genre, and it would be the same with, you know, old house tunes. It wasn't set, and now everything's like, oh, it's this kind of a game or it's this kind, you know. It was like a Doom-like game, you know. It wasn't FPS. There was,
Just for reference then for the listeners, it was Halifax, wasn't it, where you were performing that night? Just before the gig, I was wandering around town and I went to a little independent computer shop. And like Paul was saying earlier, he likes to go to the computer shops wherever he's going. And I looked to my right and there's Paul. And I was like, oh, hello, Paul. And he was so gracious. And he said, oh, hello, what's your name? And shook my hand and really very nice. And I said, what are you looking for? And he's, yeah, I'm looking for a copy of Silent Hill on the PlayStation. And the guy behind the counter was like, oh, good luck with that, mate. It's like £100 a copy now. And it's like, do you think you'll ever find that copy of Silent Hill, the original?
I did actually get one.
You did?
I did get one. And then that's when I discovered my PlayStation was slightly quirky and wouldn't accept any of my save game cards. So it kept playing it and then having to start again. And it's like as you know, you would get bored, wouldn't you? So you saved the day with your supercharged PS2 with Silent Hill on it. I have to say as well, you know, when I first met Pete, he was wearing an 808 State T-shirt. Just throw that out there. It's like, you know,
so you could spot the kind of guy he was.
To be fair, I got the train with Graham, so you know, whatever's my allegiance.
Well, I know it's a tricky one, wasn't it? You had to wear one or the other.
Well, I was wondering if you can have any mention of the computers and stuff in your biography as well. And how's that coming along?
Well, the biography was something we started a while back and then stopped doing because Phil didn't want to do it anymore. And it may happen again. I mean, I started writing a personal biography quite a number of years ago. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to start at the beginning. And I was doing all that pain thing of thinking, well, what do you include? What don't you include? And I thought, right, just start from the first things you can remember and just keep writing it, whatever comes to mind, whatever's interesting. And I got to about 220 pages and I was still only 22. So obviously there's a lot of stuff in there that would need editing out, but I did start to do it and I might just sit down and do that again another day because I thought it might be the interesting angle for me is to write. I would never try and write a history of techno because I've read a few books like that and I just find them kind of slightly annoying because they're writing it as if it's canon, as if this is it. This is the history of techno instead of writing it. Well, this is how I saw it at the time. And from my angle, I saw this. And it's kind of misleading. And you know, obviously everybody sees everything in a different way. So for me, it's more about writing what it was like to be a foot soldier in the trenches of dance music through the 90s. You know, I can't give you a massive overview. I can tell you what I saw and how I saw it.
Because you see so many techno documentaries that are just repeats of the same story over and over again. And it's good to get it from the individual perspective.
Yeah. And I think if everybody wrote them like that, then you can kind of piece together your own final history by reading everybody's individual account, you know, which of course will never add up to one solid constant, but there will be a few things in there that people go, oh, okay. Yeah. That seemed to be big around there, you know, around that time and that kind of thing. But yeah, no, it's interesting. It's interesting. But that's how I would do it. I've got someone actually on me at the moment trying to get us to do another book, you know, in a similar vein to the Chemical Brothers one. But for me, it's a bit too coffee table. I haven't read it, I don't know. It might not be as the book part, but looking there's a lot of pictures and it's like, I hope it's got more substance than just pictures. I'll read it because, you know, this guy really wants to write it. And actually that's often a good way of working with people if someone's got enthusiasm for a project. But I'm also slightly skeptical because I kind of want to write it myself, but I don't mind the idea of it being ghost written by somebody else as long as you get out what you want to say. But I do find writing is a different discipline to speaking, and you tend to go over it much quicker when you're speaking and you miss a lot of the detail, whereas if you write it down, as you're writing each paragraph, it reminds you of something else and it has a different kind of rhythm to it. So, well, you'll see. It may happen one day.
Well, I was wondering, as our final question, are you up to anything else as well and anything we can look forward to?
Yeah, I'm doing a Christmas movie at the minute. Not acting, of course, just doing the music, which is great.
Oh, nice. It's
just begun, but I can't say what it is or, well, I can say when it's coming out, and that's Christmas, but... I don't know how much I can say about
this Christmas or next Christmas, eh?
No, definitely this Christmas, which is interesting, doing a Christmas movie in the summer.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess that's when you have to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Schedule. Who knew? Yeah. You know, you don't think about it, do you? And then it's like, oh, yeah, of course. No Christmas movie was ever written at Christmas. Yeah, of course. You know, it's always written in the summer. But I've got some, you know, I used to be I did a couple of years of Morris dancing. So obviously I've got my Morris dancing bells, which are doubling up as sleigh bells and proving to be very, very effective. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't see that one coming either.
Glad you saved them. Well, Paul, it's been fantastic having you on. I've really enjoyed our chat. And yeah, it's excellent. And I can't wait to see your Christmas movie, but also some extra stuff. And, you know, everybody should check out Orbital and listen to some pioneering rave music as well.
Yeah, well, you know, thanks for having me on. It's been really refreshing doing an interview with a whole bunch of questions that I never get asked, you know, not to put other people down that interview you, but when, you know, when you've been doing this for 30 years, you do tend to get asked the same questions, which is fine, you know, but it's really nice when you get to talk about other things like Dungeon Master and Fallout, you know. Great. Thanks.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Did I put the clothes in the dryer?
I hope they don't think I was serious. I need to be awake.
Snacks. I put my brain shut
just
off.
Sleep already.
When your racing thoughts keep you up at night, it's tough to let go and get the rest you need. Better sleep can help. You might have heard of white or brown noise. There's a whole rainbow of color noises, and they can help you calm your mind, reduce stress, and sleep better, like the green noise you're listening to now. With the Better Sleep app, you can discover more color noises and over 200 soothing sounds, guided meditations, and bedtime stories. High-quality rest is vital to your mental well-being and physical health. Calm your restless mind, conquer your day, and sleep better at night. Download Better Sleep from the App Store or Google Play and start a 7-day trial today. Because when you sleep better, you feel better.